Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand, Dorothy Gundy, and Pete Musto. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, a new study suggests many Americans have not visited the most popular places of interest around the country or even in their hometown. The study found that 25% of Americans have yet to visit iconic landmarks in their own cities. 23% said they had not visited any of the nation's natural wonders, famous buildings, or historic battlefields. The study was a project of the research service OnePoll and Zipcar, a car-sharing company. Researchers questioned 2,000 Americans. Only 33% of them said they had been to Niagara Falls, and just 28% had been to Arizona's Grand Canyon. The study showed that only 30% had been to New York's Empire State Building. Only 22% had ever visited the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Many Americans say they would like to travel more. More than half of those questioned said they would like to get out more. 49% reported being creatures of habit. By that, they mean they generally do the same things in the same way. That would leave little time to visit local or national landmarks. The researchers found that the main reasons keeping Americans from exploring their cities or the country were money, lack of time, and a lack of good transportation. On social media, one Twitter user reacting to the study named a few reasons for not visiting famous places. The writer noted that most of us don't get paid days off, get punished for taking a day off, or simply can't afford to visit anything or go anywhere anymore. The Twitter user added, "Childcare costs more than college, college loans cost more than a mortgage payment, and jobs don't even pay for one of those things." The study found that three of the places Americans wanted to visit were Grand Canyon National Park, Yellowstone National Park, and the Statue of Liberty. The researchers also found that on average, Americans go to a new coffee shop every 5 months and a new restaurant every 4 months. They also spent time at a lake or near the ocean once every 6 months and go to a park every 5 months.
Big things are happening in the Seaport District of Boston, Massachusetts. General Electric is building its new world headquarters there. Amazon plans to bring in thousands of its workers to the district. The sign of Reebok, the footwear and clothing business, sits on top of the new office it opened last year. The Associated Press reports that three technology companies are testing self-driving cars in the area. In addition, crews are busy building restaurants and apartment housing. But after bad flooding this past winter, critics are wondering if it is a good idea to put so many people on a man-made peninsula that sits just above the sea level. That was the first winter where we really saw waves splashing onto the boardwalk and water in the streets, said Greg Hoffmeister. He watched the flooding from the third-floor seaport office of his business. He added, "You start to think, is that what we're in for as sea levels rise?" Boston officials say they are taking steps to prepare for increased flooding and rising sea levels. When English settlers arrived in 1630, the city covered an area of about 200 hectares. Now it is much larger and includes over 2,000 hectares of man-made landfill. We know the water is going to be coming in through South Boston, pretty much from every direction, by 2070, noted Richard McGinnis, a city planner. He was talking about the neighborhood that includes the Seaport District. A 2016 city report predicted that sea levels could rise up to 20 centimeters by the year 2030, with the seaport area most affected. By 2070, seas could rise 91 centimeters higher than water levels in 2000, affecting some 90,000 people and 12,000 buildings in the area. The economic losses could be in the billions, the report said. While some developers are designing buildings to survive climate change, many structures that were put up years ago are not ready. Environmental activists and some researchers believe Boston officials should be trying harder to change development patterns.
Officials say they are looking at ways to change and improve the city's building rules. They are also considering large and costly public work projects to hold the water back. One proposal calls for building a barrier across Boston Harbor. That project could cost $12 billion and take 30 years to complete. Last October, the Boston Planning and Development Agency also amended its climate ready checklist for developers. The list requires them to explain how the buildings they design will help lessen the effects of climate change. But the city does not require developers to follow through, noted Bradley Campbell, president of the Conservation Law Foundation, an environmental group. Boston officials say that many newer seaport developers are preparing for the worst. General Electric moved its headquarters from Connecticut to temporary offices in Boston's seaport in 2016. The company says the first floor of its new offices will be raised nearly 1.5 meters, or enough to protect it from the higher sea levels. Electrical systems are also being put on the second floor, and emergency power supplies will be on top of the 12-floor building. The developers of Seaport Square say its buildings stayed dry last winter because of their design. "We believe in science," said Yanni Sispis of WS Development. Seaport Square is a mix of offices, apartment buildings, and stores. Amazon says 2,000 of its workers will one day occupy space on the property.
But environmental activists warn much of the district simply is not ready for the rising sea levels. Many young people have moved to the area in recent years. It has become one of the city's most pricey neighborhoods. The weakest structures are historic buildings. It is very costly and sometimes impossible to improve them, city officials have said. A federal report released recently found that nationally, high tide flooding is happening at 2 times the rate it was just 30 years ago. The report warned that flooding records will continue to be broken for many years. By the International Airport in East Boston, the city government is investing in a 2-meter-high temporary flood wall. In Charlestown, where the Battle of Bunker Hill was fought during the American Revolution, crews are raising the main street more than half a meter. I'm Susan Shand.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Scientists have identified 3 genes that may have played an important part in a major development in human evolution. The genes are being linked to the increase in brain size that took place in ancestors of human beings. This increase led to the development of mental abilities that define what it means to be human. Researchers published 2 reports on their observations of the genes in the publication Cell in late May. The researchers believe the genes first appeared between 3 and 4 million years ago. This was just before a period in the fossil record that shows a major brain enlargement in the species from which humans evolved. The 3 genes share almost the exact same qualities. Along with a 4th one that seems to serve no purpose, they are called NOTCH2NL genes. They came from a gene family believed to have developed hundreds of millions of years ago. They are also important in the development of embryos. The NOTCH2NL genes are especially active in the collection of nerve stem cells in the cerebral cortex. The cerebral cortex is the outer part of the brain responsible for the highest mental processes. These include language, memory, and reasoning. The genes were found to slow the development of stem cells in the cerebral cortex into neurons in the embryo. The researchers say this delay leads to the production of a higher number of more developed nerve cells in this area of the brain. Pierre Vanderhagen is a developmental neurobiologist at the Université Libre de Bruxelles in Belgium. He told the Reuters news service that, in part, the cerebral cortex is responsible for what defines humans as a species and as individuals. Understanding how it emerged in evolution is a fascinating question, touching at the basic origins of mankind, said Vanderhagen. David Hausler is a biomolecular engineer and the scientific director of the University of California, Santa Cruz Genomics Institute. He added that it is the ultimate evolutionary question and a very interesting area of research in which to work. The species Australopithecus afarensis is an ancestor of humans that combined both ape-like and human-like qualities. The well-known fossil named Lucy, discovered in Ethiopia in 1974, was a member of that species. Lucy lived in Africa at about the time these genes are believed to have appeared. Sophie Salama is a UC Santa Cruz biomolecular engineering research scientist. She said it would be great if it were possible to record the complete order of all of Lucy's genetic material, her DNA. But she noted that it would be nearly impossible. The NOTCH2NL genes are not present in the closest genetic relatives of human beings. None were found in monkeys or orangutans. However, Reuters News reports that the researchers did find the genes in the remains of two human ancestor species, Neanderthals and Denisovans. NOTCH2NL gene abnormalities were found to be connected to problems that affect the brain. These include autism, schizophrenia, and both unusually large and unusually small head size. I'm Pete Musto.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Steve Ember and Shirley Griffith talk about Calvin Coolidge and how he became president of the United States.
The early 1920s were a troubled time for the United States. Congress and the public began to discover crimes by several officials in the administration of President Warren Harding. Harding himself became seriously sick during a trip to Alaska and western states. He died in a hotel room in California in August 1923. Harding's vice president, Calvin Coolidge, became the new president. Both men were Republicans. Their policies on issues were much the same. Coolidge, however, was a very different man. He was completely honest. He was the kind of president the country needed to rebuild public trust in the government.
Calvin Coolidge was quiet and plain-looking. He was the son of a farmer and political leader from the small northeastern state of Vermont. Young Calvin worked at different jobs to pay for his college education. He became a lawyer. He moved to another northeastern state, Massachusetts, where he became active in Republican Party politics. First, he was elected mayor of the town. Then he was elected to the state legislature. Finally, he was elected governor of Massachusetts. It was as governor that Coolidge first became known throughout the United States.
In 1919, a group of policemen in the city of Boston tried to start a labor union. This violated the rules of the police department. So the commissioner of police suspended 19 of the union's leaders. The next day, almost 75% of Boston's policemen went on strike. Criminals walked freely through the city for two nights. They robbed stores and threatened public safety. Frightened Americans all across the country waited to see what Governor Coolidge would do.
He took strong action. He called on state troops to end the strike. He said, "There is no right to strike against the public safety by anybody anywhere, anytime. Most Americans approved of what Coolidge did. The people of Massachusetts supported him, too. They re-elected him governor by a large number of votes. Then, in 1920, Republicans nominated Warren Harding for president. They nominated Calvin Coolidge for vice president. When President Harding died in California, Coolidge, his wife, and two sons moved to the White House.
America's 30th president was, in some ways, an unusual kind of person to lead the country. He said little. He showed few feelings. Coolidge's policies as president were not active. He tried to start as few new programs as possible. He was a conservative Republican who believed deeply that government should be small. Coolidge expressed his belief this way: if the federal government should go out of existence, most people would not note the difference. And once, he said, 4/5 of our troubles in this life would disappear if we would only sit down and keep still.
Coolidge believed that private business, not the federal government, should lead the country to greater wealth and happiness. He continued President Harding's policy of supporting American business both inside the United States and in other countries. The government under President Coolidge continued high taxes on imports in an effort to help American companies.
Many Americans shared Coolidge's ideas about small government and big business. In the early 1920s, many of them were living better than ever before. At that time, companies were growing larger. The prices of their stocks rose higher and higher. There were lots of jobs, and the wages of many workers increased. Americans agreed with their president that there was little need for government spending and government programs when private industry seemed so strong.
The American economy grew in the 1920s for several reasons. The World War had destroyed many factories and businesses in Europe. The United States did not suffer the same destruction. It was still a young country. It had great natural resources, trained workers, and a huge market within its own borders. When peace came, Americans found their economy stronger than any other in the world.
Changes in the American market also helped economic growth. Installment buying became popular. In this system, people could buy a product and pay for it over a period of several weeks or months. The total cost was higher because they had to pay interest. But the system made it possible for more people to buy more goods. It also made the idea of borrowing money more acceptable to many Americans.
The growing importance of the New York stock markets also helped economic growth in the 1920s. Millions of Americans bought shares of stock in companies that seemed to grow bigger every month. Such investment almost became a national game. People would buy shares of stock, then sell them when the stock rose in value. There were many stories of poor people who became rich overnight by buying the right stocks. The American Congress also helped the economy by lowering income taxes. People had more money to spend on new goods. Another important reason for economic growth was a change in the way American companies were operated.
During the 1920s, the idea of manufacturing goods in the most scientific way became very popular. The father of this idea of scientific management was an engineer, Frederick Taylor. Mr. Taylor developed a system to study manufacturing. He studied each machine involved in the process. He studied how much work each person did. He studied how goods moved from one part of a factory to another. Then he offered ideas to business owners about ways to produce goods faster and for less cost.
Taylor's ideas of scientific management appealed to business owners. Automobile manufacturer Henry Ford proved that the ideas could work in his new car factory in the state of Michigan. Ford used the assembly line system of production. In this system, each worker did one thing to a product as it moved through the factory. This helped cut prices and increase wages.
Ford and other businessmen learned a great deal about how to control costs, set prices, and decide how much to produce. All these changes in production and marketing helped Ford and other American companies grow larger and stronger. Henry Ford's Model T car became popular throughout the country. So did other new products, radios, refrigerators for cooling food, vacuums to clean carpets, ready-made cigarettes, beauty products. Americans in the 1920s began to buy all kinds of new products they had never used before.
Calvin Coolidge was in the White House. However, business led the nation. Times were good. Americans trusted business and its leaders. It became an honor to call someone a businessman. Colleges organized business classes. Middle-class citizens in almost every city and town gathered to discuss business ideas. President Coolidge spoke for millions of Americans when he said, "The chief business of the American people is business."
Coolidge represented traditional values and a simple way of life. He knew exactly how every dollar he earned was saved or spent, and he spent no more money than was necessary. The strange thing was that Coolidge was extremely popular with a public that was spending large amounts of money. Some economic experts warned that the country's quick economic growth would end in economic depression. Most Americans, however, believed that the good times had come to stay. They enjoyed the good things in life that work and success in business could bring. On our next program, we will see how the economic growth of the 1920s brought exciting changes to the day-to-day life of millions of Americans.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.